Hello and welcome. You're listening to Enemies of Good Art on Resonance 104.4 FM. The title of today's show is Rethinking Pocahontas, and one of my guests will explain that in a minute. We're looking at educational, societal, cultural and cultural influences, where we discuss what it means to educate girls and boys today. I'm joined by teachers Vagini Lakshmikanthan and her sister, coincidentally, Kamini Lakshmikanthan. And I hope I've done that correctly, and also by Brian Channer. And Brian is the director of New Britain, a non-profit organisation focused on educational development, supporting young people's interest in learning through arts and media. Vagini manages the inclusion department at Sydenham High School, where she works with girls and young women with emotional and behavioural barriers to learning. And Kamini teaches at St. Mark's C of E Academy in Mitcham. She has a special interest in science and the education of young women. And I have grossly cut down their biographies because, and they're laughing, and I'm so sorry, but our little bit on the schedule won't accommodate anymore because it's quite impressive what the three of you have done individually and collectively. We met last Saturday. That shows you how far in advance I programmed these shows. But we met last Saturday at a Women of the World think-in at the South Bank Centre, leading up to this year's, or next year's, I should say, second Women of the World Festival at the South Bank Centre in March 2012. And of course, we're all attending because we're all interested in the subject or subjects relating to women's issues. And we were all very excited to see three men in the room, of which I've managed to snare one of them here tonight. So, Brian, you're very welcome. Not that I want to single you out.
Thank you.
I should also say that we're joined by Cecily, and our film of choice tonight is The Lion King. Mark on the desk, and he's assisted by Charlotte tonight. So we have a full studio. And perhaps, you know, if Mark and Charlotte want to join in the discussion, they're very welcome, although I doubt it. Oh, the excuse is there are no microphones, so there you go. Anyway, we're going to talk a little bit about Women of the World Festival and what brought you to it. So perhaps, Brian, because you're closest to me, I could start with you. In terms of the work that you do, your organisation, and how your interests in women's issues, and particularly young women's issues.
Yeah, well, I'm co-founder of a company, as you said before, called New Britain. And actually what we really focus on is actually creating like ad hoc programs to actually deal with various issues that young people actually face. And I was actually invited to the Women of the World by a colleague of mine called Vagini, who I've actually worked with in the past. And, you know, my direct interest is anything that actually looks at serious ways of actually changing and developing young people. You know, I really want to be a part of. So that's what actually brought me to the WOW function over the weekend.
And in terms of New Britain, if you could tell us briefly what it means and what your organisation does and why you set it up.
Okay, yeah. Well, the reason why we actually set it up really was for a twofold reason. Number one, I think I remember reading the newspapers, Tony Blair's comment about multiculturalism doesn't work. And the third thing that really came to my mind is, how was it supposed to work and what does it mean it doesn't work? Mm. And also it was, I wanted to create a forum for young people to feel inclusive in this society, all young people, and actually understand their contribution to, you know, making Britain new, hence the title name of our company, New Britain. And also, you know, when we worked with lots of young people, they were actually telling us their needs, and we were actually developing alongside young people programs that actually fed into trying to find a solution or trying to get them to think about finding a solution for their needs as well. So to name a couple of our programs, we created a program called The Double X Factor, and that program looked at exploring women's identity and asking the question, what is a woman in the 21st century? Because if we have a look at mass media, it gives us so many different conflicting imagery and messages. It's very confusing to understand, you know, what is a woman in the 21st century. So we created a program just to examine that. Mm. Also, along with Vagini, we actually came into her schools and we did a program called the Be Me Project. And what that allowed young people to do was talk about abstract art, but also to articulate their emotion through abstract art and have a chance to kind of almost map how they feel about life and how they feel about themselves. And we also allow them to have a forum where they could interview each other to just investigate and explore what makes them tick and what's valuable about them. And at the end of that, we're going to bring them all together to do a massive art exhibition. Mm. Now, you know, this is a very important program because it really allows people that don't normally have a voice or really haven't really thought about their identity or what really influences them to actually have a forum to actually explain themselves or, you know, articulate their emotions as well. And, you know, there were a couple of really good cases as well that allowed even teachers to have a greater understanding of how to deal with these, you know, deal with particular young students as well. Mm.
Okay. Carmony.
Hi. I've been a teacher for 12 years and I've taught in a number of schools, a mixed single sex, girls and boys. And last year, for the last 2 years, I was taught in a girls' school. And what I found quite amazing, when you teach in a single sex school, especially at girls' schools, girls feel quite empowered to be, and they feel quite natural to be quite vocal and motivated to study with each other. And it's a great dynamics. Now, going to St. Mark's, which is a mixed school, I've actually noticed that the boys dominate the classroom. They dominate in the way they interact, they dominate how they talk, and they dominate in how they sort of shout girls down to some extent. Mm. And so what I find, though, even though they do dominate the classroom, their achievement levels are still below the girls in that sort of, and when it comes to attainments, and I find that quite interesting as a dynamic. So what sort of motivated me to sort of attend Women of the World conference is basically how I thought the power struggles in the classroom had changed, and it hadn't as much. And that sort of really quite shocked me. And I thought, and also how boys perceive girls and women in the school, my particular school, and how they still use those reference points, and how girls really do perceive themselves haven't changed either. So I thought it'd be quite interesting to get involved in it. And what came out of the sort of discussion groups was actually the necessity to take Women of the World to schools, to start having a dialogue as opposed to just a monologue of girls and women getting involved in activities, but actually getting boys involved as well. So there's a dialogue going on. And when you've got teenage young people, they're formulating their views about womanhood, manhood, and the interactions of gender. Mm. So I think this is a good opportunity to try and really open up the debate and let them communicate and see each other, really see each other in each other's eyes, in each other's sort of roles, and see it from a different viewpoint. So I'm quite excited about the prospect. I sort of was jabbering to all my colleagues when I went back on Monday about the actual beautiful experience of meeting these amazing professional women. And I had a great opportunity to take one of my students who came from a similar background as me, a Sri Lankan background, and she's been oppressed, and I'm not going to say it in a very, I say that in a very strong way, she felt oppressed by the fact that within our community, it's in some aspects, not all communities, Sri Lankan communities, the males are very dominant and their needs and their freedoms are taken care of. Whereas the girls, there's a lot more restriction. So I have these young women, one's the first generation, one's the second generation Sri Lankan girls, and they're beginning to find the struggle of being brought up in a Western multicultural society and having to sort of address their cultural needs as well. And as an Asian woman, Sri Lankan Asian woman, sometimes it can be quite a tight restraint on them. And they're wanting to have the same levels of freedoms they're seeing their friends have. So that was my motivation for coming.
Well, that certainly is a good one. And Carmony, where you, Vargany, sorry, you come from the other side, of course, where you're teaching an all-girls school.
Yeah. Yes, I've worked in an all-girls school for the last four years now. I vowed that I never ever would work in a girls' school because of the dynamics of girls being quite, they're very emotional creatures, our young girls, but they're very, I find that I can do a lot with them, but their emotions and their psychology get in the way. What I've noticed about working in the girls' school, although relationships are a big issue, and when they come from primary school, I've noticed that a lot of young children are harmed by the breakup of their friendships, And it really does get in the way of them progressing through their learning, because that's where they're at. So in my school, we have to work on a lot on building relationships and how the dynamics of relationships and friendships, and why is it important that they go through conflict and that they go through these making and breaking, because no one teaches them how relationships operate, how girls operate. And I can see that sometimes they're very quite cruel to each other they're very judgmental at each other, and yet sometimes they can be very close and very nurturing. So I thought I would never work in a girls' school, but here I am now in my fourth year doing lots of projects with them, and I do actually like going into work. I'm really excited by the prospect of doing quite a lot of projects. One of the projects that Brian said was the Be Me project, and what we're finding in the way of inclusion that a lot of young people are experiencing a lot of emotional problems due to family breakup or the economic crisis is actually filtering down now to the young people, and that they've actually got they're actually experiencing the problems of society now, and a lot of issues around their emotions. Some of it might come out in self-harm. One of the projects that we did with Brian was the Be Me project, and the idea was to really look at their emotions and how they articulate their emotions and their emotional literacy through the art. And they were able to in an abstract way, gather artistic images that represented them and the words that they wanted to communicate. And they produced really lovely art pieces, but we could understand what was really going on with them as the art was emerging. And what I want to do is to explore it with a really trained psychotherapist now, because psychotherapy and the sort of counselling needs to come into our work now more, because children need a voice to understand their emotions. So I think now that I'm in this school, I want to be able to explore it a little bit more, the emotional literacy.
Do you think your students are picking up on what's happening today, for example, and the student march that's taking place or that has taken place through central London?
It hasn't come up before now, but the original march, they really did pick up. Some of the girls did go, and I think in other schools they did go. So they had a big voice, but they didn't pick it up this time round. But I think they're picking up the climate, the social climate a little bit. Yeah, they've got a voice, but they need a little bit more of a forum to express it.
Can you imagine taking them to the St. Paul's occupation? Would it be some... I mean, I'm asking provocatively because, you know, we did a little thing a while ago with Occupy Half Term, this amazing mother in Cambridge who got together with another group of mothers in Cambridge. And the idea being that they bring their children down to St. Paul's to educate. So the argument being that if you take your children shopping during half term, you're teaching them about consumerism. Yeah. You're teaching them about a capitalist society that we live in. But if you take them to St. Paul's and you get them to meet the protesters and get to see the occupation, that you teach them about politics and what's happening in society.
Well, we can't... in that kind of remit, it's that kind of environment. We can talk about it, we can debate about it, and it's actually given them an opportunity to formulate their own opinions. Mm. But actually supporting... I mean, last year I had, when I was in my secondary school, the girls' school up in North London, I had a number of students who actually supported their wishes to go on the march. I support it in private, but the line was that we could not... let them out of the school to go on these marches, even though I thought it was their democratic right. So I felt quite sort of torn with my my duties as a teacher and actually what my personal views were.
But then you have a duty of care to them, so while they're in your care, then that's understandable. I'm just not to dwell too long on the idea of co-ed as opposed to single-sex schools, but until I had Cecily... the idea of single-sex, I didn't think they really existed in my naivety. And I'm wondering, I mean, Brian, you've also got experience of working in a single-sex school through your collaborations. Can we argue the case for single-sex schools anymore?
I personally, just seeing the dynamics and how the girls that I taught in my previous school have excelled by... Because I teach science, and that's sort of classically no longer used to be viewed as a male subject, and especially physics. But having a single-sex school, I found that the girls could feel free to voice their sort of, even their misconceptions about the subject, even their sort of opinions about it. When I find out at the moment, and I just had a lesson today and I sort of reflected on it, I actually found, because the boys, when they dominate, they sort of almost stop the girls from able to open up and express themselves. And I have to pointedly say, this is a no-hands policy in this room. I'm going to ask strategic questions, and I have to go around and ask individuals and have a balance between boys and girls answering questions. But I do find that the boys will be ready to put their hands up and ask questions and answer questions, or even ask questions that are quite sort of testing and also exploring, where the girls will sit back and feel very sort of timid and almost feel intimidated. But when I was in my girls' school, I found a number of my students were really willing to try and explore subjects a bit more deep, and I felt quite comfortable in talking to me about it. So in a way, I'm kind of torn, because some part of me says that you shouldn't do. You should have gender equality in the classroom, and actually those dynamics should be there in a mixed school. And I think, but you can see that there's a bit of a power play being played in that classroom, and it perpetuates that sort of thing that boys dominate and girls sort of are suppressed.
Yeah, I would tend to sort of agree with you. I mean, it's a double-edged sword, really, because I think also it depends what subject we're actually talking about, because I think the openness to express yourself, I think sometimes if the opposite sex is actually in the room, you can feel slightly restricted. So I think there's definitely forums for single-sex learning, but also there's equally, there's a lot of benefit when you can join the both sexes together to actually debate.
I think when I was talking to my friend who's an English teacher, and she says that it seems to be the opposite, because we were talking about maths and science, and a maths teacher, we were talking about the fact that achievement in maths, even though boys are very vocal, very sort of active, but they don't achieve as much, and the same, I've noticed the same in science. But my friend who teaches English, she was saying that actually you find it with the social where the girls feel they can express their opinions, where they can be more so creative expression, they seem to be much more vocal in the classroom, and boys sit back a bit more. So there's certain dynamics that some, maybe in science you could have single sex, in maths you can have single sex, and now a free or a woman only, or girls only space for them, or a boy only space for them to actually achieve in. And maybe in other subjects they could come together to, maybe like in sociology, or maybe like in art or DT, or where they can actually work together collaboratively.
I mean, I worked in a boys' school in Tower Hamlets, I found that experience quite a difficult experience. I felt that in that area they were very fixed, the boys' perceptions were very fixed, even the male teachers were very fixed. I couldn't even begin to be very creative at all, and I actually had to leave that school because I felt I had come to a glass ceiling with that, with the boys and the males. It was I felt it was quite misogynistic actually. Although I thought I would only work in a boys' school, but I think that area was just not an area for me.
So maybe that girls seem to thrive better in a girls-only space, where boys do need to have females in there to actually learn the skills of gender equality.
Yeah. That's how I felt, really, because I couldn't really go beyond. It was a very traditional curriculum. Yeah. They didn't, it was very, they didn't do drama, they did construction, they did DT. It was very, very male dominated, right, and so the girls and the women did suffer in that.
So it's perpetuating those stereotypes, gender inequalities.
Yeah, I think there's definitely space to actually look at what's happening between the dynamics between young women and young men. And also there's also another space to actually look at peer pressure and actually what does it mean to our learning, and and what kind of answers are we going to give if we're in a single sex room opposed to both sexes in the room as well. Because I have noticed that the attitudes when you mix a class, it does change. And a yes, or, you know, for a young man especially, to show some form of insecurity when there's women in the room, it becomes problematic.
Okay, I think we all remember, I remember my co-ed school and, you know, fancying a boy in the class and not wanting to sound like an idiot. Or also being very conscious of the fact that my uniform skirt wasn't as tight and as short as, we'll say, somebody else's. And so therefore, or my hair didn't look so good. And, you know, around that 14, 15, 15, 16 perhaps, when one's very subconscious about body image and sexual politics, then really begin to kick off, especially for the girls as we're maturing a bit quicker. But we started off conversation, I don't know how it started on Saturday, and I don't know, did I mention something about the crap children are watching or something, and we started to talk about Pocahontas.
Oh, yeah.
And before I knew it, Brian let loose on this fantastic rant about how the whole story has been misappropriated and twisted. Well, we know what Disney will do to anything. But I was completely shocked because I had no idea about Pocahontas or the story behind it. But in terms of how a story can become thwarted in some way to satisfy a particular audience, and most particularly, and this is what we were talking about, how women are presented as sexual beings.
Most definitely. Most definitely. I mean, when we actually look at the story of Pocahontas, I mean, one thing that seems to be left out of the story is her opinions and her views.
Right.
So, you know, when I was doing my own research, first of all, you hear about what the chief says, because she was like supposed to be a princess.
Right.
So you got his opinion of her. And then you've got the English settlers, their opinion of her.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got their tribespeople, their opinion of her. So,
and she did actually exist.
Yeah, she did actually exist. Actually, her name wasn't Pocahontas. That was actually a nickname given to her. And the definition of Pocahontas means a wanton child or wanton woman, which is not exactly a positive definition.
But the definition of wanton.
Yeah, the definition of wanton itself. I mean, I did a little bit of research and I had a look at a couple of different definitions. Let me see if I can actually find one or two. So we have here, a wanton means, is basically synonymous with... Sorry, let me have a look now. Sorry, that's it. It looks at a wanton woman. Is a woman who's disproved of, because she enjoys sex and has sex with a lot of men. That was one definition. Another one is a frisky woman. Another one is sexually immodest or promiscuous. And that's just to name a few. There's a lot of kind of negative connotations around being a wanton woman. So therefore, this was her nickname. So Pocahontas, direct translation, means a wanton woman. Her actual name was Motoka. And when she got married, she had a Christian name, which was Rebecca Rolfe. That was her name. And I think what I was actually talking about on over the weekend is... It's really important when we hear a story that the person is not objectified.
Yeah.
And I think Pocahontas, if you know, she's basically being quite objectified. She's been used for so many different political means. And this fervor sometimes serves the purpose of actually suppressing women further or reiterating, you know, stereotypes that women actually have placed upon them.
Mm.
You know, like the sexual promiscuous being without a voice.
Mm.
So it's really important. And it's also because it's been made into a Disney character and she's been made into an icon. Yeah. So we have to, you know, definitely kind of question this and actually look at the values that are coming down to the younger generation especially, because sometimes they will absorb it without actually questioning it.
Mm.
So, you know, this is something for us to actually do and to look into.
But visually, she's this figure that is, you know, flawless with an impossibly thin waist.
Absolutely.
And huge boobs and legs that go on forever.
Do you know what? It actually reminds me, there was like a very old picture. Paintings. It was two paintings, and one was, it was both of native women. Mm. And it was, one was done by a man and the other one was done by a native woman herself. And they painted the same woman, and the man's version, she was really delicate, slim waist, as you said, big boobs, and you know, very voluptuous, a very sexual being. And the woman's version, the woman was a lot more harder, quite, you know, stout, strong.
She probably had three or four kids already.
Yeah. But if you had a look at her lifestyle was very, very kind of hands-on. She would have done lots of heavy lifting. Mm. So the man's portrayal of her was obviously more erotic and exotic. Mm. And it was really for a purpose of sexual satisfaction or sexual glorification. Mm-hmm. And the woman's preconception of the same woman now was much more realistic. Mm. It was a real person in society. And you can see she was trying to paint out this is a woman with a character and a personality with wants. And it's just more than just a sexual being. Mm-hmm. She's a person.
But you have a great interest in how women are portrayed and indeed feminist values and ideals. And I think you even got asked this on Saturday, because I think if there's a man in the room supporting anything to do with, you know, with feminism, we're wondering why. So I'm wondering where you come from on this, because there aren't that many men who are willing to stick their hand up and say, look, we're willing to help out here. I'm sure there are many, but they haven't come forward.
I think, as I said before, I mean, when we actually started the company, me and my business partner, Andrew Sinclair, what we wanted to do is actually take down barriers, was to investigate the barrier and dispel the myth. Mm. Because a lot of our behavior is actually just learnt. So, we've got the gender of a woman and then you've got the sex of the woman. And, you know, what goes into that is lots of learnt behavior. And we have to also work out how women are actually defined. And that's what I'm really interested in, about looking at how cultures are defined or how people or races are actually defined. And one of the key aspects of actually looking at, let's say, a woman's identity is they're actually created from the perspective of the other.
Right.
So the key to what defines the woman is sometimes the man's needs.
Mm.
Yeah. So the man has to put her in a particular voiceless and characteristically invisible kind of place where she's a shape. And she's a thing.
Mm.
And I'm really, as I said before, we're very interested of actually just building that voice back into reality, or that faceless face back into a visual perception, so we can actually see the person. Because, you know, when you objectify somebody, you take away their power and then you can abuse them. And I was given an example just the other day. If you have a look at the idea of a woman, and you think, okay, now, you know, if we had a list of negative preconceptions we can have, or negative titles we can have for a woman, the list goes on and on forever.
Yeah.
But if we have a look at a man, the list is much shorter, because a man is less objectified than a woman. It makes a lot of sense. So therefore, it's really kind of peeling back the layers that sometimes have actually blinded men and women now in society to the identification and the real characteristics of a woman.
Mm.
And I think I said this over the weekend. As soon as you start to define a woman, you're already wrong, because there should be no definition that should go on to her, because it should be infinite.
Mm.
So, as I said before, you know, this is a great interest for, you know, myself personally, but also our company, you know, the things that we actually investigate and we try to dispel is, you know, the myths that actually separates us from what we can and cannot do. And sometimes we have to take down the barriers of sexuality, or take down barriers of race or culture or religion. Mm. And we actually see this consistently and continuously played out in the media's eyes.
Absolutely.
So, you know, even like now with the, you know, after the tragedies of the 9/11, you know, we've got these phantoms called, you know, Al-Qaeda, and we've got terrorists, but there's no real distinction of what are you talking about. It's just these vague descriptions of the boogeyman.
Mm.
And the same thing when it goes into the woman. When you objectify a woman, it's this vague description of the boogeyman kind of, you know, characteristics of what it is to be a woman.
Mm.
And it's, yeah, so we feel like it's quite empowering when we, you know, when we're able to give back that voice to the voiceless people, regardless of, you know, which direction they're coming from.
Well, in the context of this discussion and the fact that you've all got, you know, great connections with young people, then is it a question of getting to them while they're young?
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, absolutely. Because that's when they're forming. They're not hardwired yet. They're still, because you only see a child in nursery, And you can see that the dynamics, it's not gendered. It has no gender sort of bias to it. And then you see, as you get older, with the influence of media, with the influence of magazines and music, and television as well, you start to see, they start to hardwire into what a man is, what a woman is. And when I started to talk to my year 10 class, which is about 14 to 15 years old, about what they think a woman is. And I could see these boys just giving me these sort of magazine connotations of a woman. And when I talked to the girls about it, and they were giving me this also this idea that what they think a woman's role is. And I felt quite shocked. I thought these sort of barriers were broken down, because I don't see them myself. I don't have them myself. And I don't perceive the girls and the boys as being different. I do know they're individuals, and I do actually respect their individuality. But it was quite telling that they are very much influenced by media. And the boys were literally describing to me a woman that was almost pornographic. and it came from a debate when we were talking about shaving and parts of their bodies. and it came from a discussion. I had to put down my lesson plan.
I bet you did.
And go. And it was actually a girl says, we were talking about hormones and influencing secondary female and male characteristics. And a girl just turned around and said, why do we have pubic hair? We'll just shave it off. It's better to be shaved off. And that became a talking point. Okay, I'm just going to sit. I'm going to start. And I was quite fired up from the weekend as well. So, all right, we're going to have a discussion about it. And actually, boys were saying they prefer their women to be hairless.
Wow. Wow. How old are these boys?
Right, 14 to 15. Right. And like I said, they were. Gosh. It was almost like pornography. And I had to say to them, why? They said, because they get all their ideas about sexual behaviour based around that. And the girls were actually influenced by that as well, because they felt that's what boys wanted them to have, to be clean shaven.
Oh gosh, at 14, I wasn't having that conversation.
It's like I remember some of the young women on my program. They actually gave a presentation to different schools, and one of the presentations there was an image, and the first image you saw was a woman's eyes, and we basically asked the audience, you know, who is this woman? What does she do? And people said, oh, she's a model. She's a hairdresser, because you could just see her eyes. And then again, we saw a bit more of the woman. And it was obvious that she was in a bikini. Uh-huh. And then they start to say, oh, she's a glamour model. She's a stripper. She's a porn star. And then the camera basically panned out. And what you saw was a woman in a bikini, in high heels, draped over this very expensive luxury sports car. Mm. So we kept on asking the questions. And this is a panel of all women. Yeah. Mm. And they said, okay, then, is this car... does this car belong to her? Mm. And the whole audience said no. Okay, then, does she drive the car? The whole audience said no. And I said, well, she's the only person in the picture with the car. So why is she in the picture? She doesn't drive the car, and she doesn't own the car. Why is she laying all over the car? Mm-hmm. And the girls basically responded in unison, because if you buy the car, you get the girl for free.
Oh my God.
You know, and this presentation was done last year, so this is not, you know, 50 years ago. These are the messages that the young women in schools are understanding today about their values. They're another commodity. Mm. So you buy the car and you get the woman free.
And that's what they're seeing. That's what they're hearing. They see it in rap music. Well, they see it in music and videos. Mm. They see it in the media. They see it in magazines. You pick up a girl's magazine. You see lots of that they actually are just a consumer object.
And I get that from where we're having to deal with girls who are being really exploited by boys and gangs. I don't want to use a cliche of gangs, but it is. It's actually, you know, where... sometimes the girls, they might just interact with a group of boys, and you might see a group of girls, and there might be just two boys holding court with the girls. And then later on, as it gets a bit sinister, the girls are used as financial commodities for the boys. So
explain that.
So what they will do is maybe take people's Oyster cards or mobile phones, and they go back to the boy gangs, and they hand over the goods, which can be then as a transaction, and then the girls are then given sexual favors or that sort of thing. So there is exploitation of our young girls, and they feel it's in their conditioning. They feel it's okay for that interaction to happen.
They were you were saying that they were trading sexual favors for materialism, for items, for a pair of trainers, for an iPod, things like that. You were telling me that was I was quite shocked by that.
But I also think it's about part of the confusing messages, like, you know, Lady Gaga.
Yeah.
You know, she's supposed to be a sex icon. Mm. She's supposed to be, you know, there's a massive difference between a powerful woman and women's power.
Yeah.
So I think we're living in a society now that money equates power, and it doesn't matter how you acquire it. You know, you're a powerful woman. So I think, you know, all these like female icons now, if we have a look at the female icons that young women have today, and this was another part of one of our presentations, we showed, you know, Beyonce, the, you know, Lady Gaga, and, you know, a number of different female icons. Everyone knew their names. And then we started to show like the female chess champion player, and no one seen it before. And then when you show women that are successful because of their brains, we're not talking just entertainment, but because of their brains in business, they're unknown. And I think this is what we do. When we grow up in society, we cover what we see. So when I say, you know, when a woman grows up and wants to be a successful woman, she actually looks at people that reflect success in her eyes. And sadly enough, it's a lot of these singers or these actresses. And when you have a look at the values that they reflect, they're not exactly very healthy.
Yeah, they're not.
I know. My heart stops when I see Rihanna, and I'm thinking, you know, the singer.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. I mean, you know, here I am, and you're a 40-year-old woman with a 3-year-old daughter, and I'm thinking, crikey.
Yeah.
I think I feel very conservative right now, but nevertheless, I fear for what she's going to have to face.
Well, I'm going to give an example of what how girls emanate, what they see. We had a cultural evening which was run by the Asdan Group, which is basically an alternative provision for students that find general academic subjects quite challenging sometimes, and it gives them an opportunity to gain skills that they can transfer into their lives. They put on and organise a very good cultural show, a programme which celebrate a diversity within the school. And they asked there, because we're a performing school as well, that the number of the girls in who's about 16, 15 and younger to put on a dance. But the dance was very, very provocative. It was literally like watching a Rihanna video. And a lot then they invited their parents to come to this evening, and the parents and the adults felt very, very uncomfortable by it. And actually some of the children did as well, the students did, because it was so provocative. But they felt it was okay to do that in a very mixed, diverse, aged sort of audience. And they didn't think there was anything wrong about it. And I didn't think that actually the messages they were giving off, well, there was nothing wrong with it at all.
But this isn't anything new.
No.
I mean,
no.
When I was a teenager, you know, Madonna was ours. and her coned, you know, cups on her bra, what was it? And so this is what we were looking at, although it does somehow feel like it's slightly worse, or am I just old and fearful?
But I mean, how I look at it is, you know, there's nothing wrong with being sexy or sexual, but as long as there's a range, as long as there's a range. And what I feel is the range is not really there anymore.
Right.
The range is not really there. So there's not a problem being, you know, as I said before, being sexual, being viewed as sexy. As long as there's a range, so people can actually feed into a number of different types of women. So when they say, you know, I'm not too sure what type of woman I want to be as they're growing up, they have a choice. This, you know, there is a range of women that's available to me.
A range of role models.
Yeah, a range of role models.
And at the moment, it's very, very, a very niche, a very small role model available out there.
And it's not only in this country. I did a project in Georgia, in Tbilisi, former Soviet state, in 2005. And I worked with children in an orphanage, and they ranged from the ages of 5 to 21. And there exists a rather, well, it's a very difficult situation, but in many countries where their mothers can't afford to keep them, so they end up in an orphanage during the week and then go home at the weekends. And these are women who have to work as sex workers to be able to support themselves at all, mostly. But so I gave the children cameras, and I asked, I didn't get the chance to ask them anything in terms of what they might photograph. A lot of them had been on the streets for some time, so in effect you could say they were feral. And they wouldn't take instruction from me. They just took the cameras and buggered off, and then came back with the camera 2 minutes later, and the entire old film's gone. So I did let them know that they would have to keep it for a little bit longer and think about what they were doing. And without exception, they all turned the camera back on themselves.
Right.
Which was incredible. But they didn't only turn the camera on themselves. They got their friends. So where I would give Diana, for example, a camera, she would get her little mate to follow her around, and then she'd pose. And here she's posing with her hand behind her head and one hand on her hip. But the teenage girls, the teenage girls turned up like porn stars. And I'm not joking.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Boobs hanging out, asses in the air. The teacher, the director of the orphanage was quite horrified. And I looked around some of the dormitories, and in every dormitory there was MTV on. And so the boys were sort of like, you know, hands on hips and sort of like looking quite relaxed and chilled out. But the girls were really going for it. And there was one that I nicknamed the star, because every picture of her, you know, is even more raunchy with every role in the film. And she's got her legs open, and she's showing her underwear, and she's only, you know, really gorgeous girls, beautiful girls. And this girl was, I think she was 15, 16. And, you know, everybody was worried for her, but you could sort of see in a way where her life was heading, tragically, because once she left the orphanage, there would be no support for her. So it's, you know, it's not just our society that somehow has become affected by the huge, you know, drive, which is this media thing that has hit
us. Media machine, as it were, isn't it?
And globalisation is sort of making, it's just spreading it more as well. You can see it in India, where you look at Indian films, where how very provocative the women are as they're dancing. But in Indian society, women can't behave that way.
No.
You can't kiss in public, but in the films, you can. You can have boyfriends and girlfriends, and you can sort of be dance very sexually and wear very sort of skimpy clothing. But you can't dress like that in society in India.
So it's a mixed message.
It is.
We're getting a mixed message
from
our Asian girls
as well. Yeah.
You know, what they see in the pictures, and what their families are allowed to watch, and what they're allowed to do is quite restricting, actually. And they're having to, like Carmony said, is to balance being British and the cultural expectations. They're having a dilemma, really.
And there's this, within our own community sometimes, there is, and it seems like it's coming strongly quite through, that actually anything that's Western is wrong, and you've got to preserve the Eastern Asian cultures. And they're trying to maintain this in this very sort of diverse multicultural society. And the younger generation are saying, but we want some freedom.
But it's interesting that you both identify as Sri Lankan.
Yeah.
But you have both told me that you were brought up by a very strong woman, single-handedly, who really impressed it upon you that education was...
Absolutely, yeah. It was her decision to break away from the restraints of our society, because my father... is a very strong patriarch, and there are expectations, and I see it with my half brother and sister, because my father remarried after my mother and father divorced, and the boy, his son has a lot more freedom. He can have a girlfriend, doesn't matter where she's from, as long as he marries a nice Asian girl, Sri Lankan girl in the end, that doesn't matter. But the daughter is very strict. They're very, very strict on her. She can't have a boyfriend. She's got to have her own arranged marriage. And that's been pressed upon her completely. And you can see the difference in the sort of the freedoms they have. My sister and I have always been very, very lucky that my mother has just said, you can choose your path. You can choose what you want to do. And she's always been quite strong about education, because she got married at the age of 17.
Right.
And when she was studying her A-levels,
and she wasn't able to pursue her educational desires of maybe going to university because of being married and being a mother at a younger age. So she really drove that home to us when we were growing up. And we saw the currency of education to move us from one social status to the other, to give us opportunity. And that's what we try and do with our girls as well, is that give them, that's your currency. If anything, no one can take away your education, even if there isn't a job at the end of it. But you have your
work. Gives you choices.
Gives you choice.
That's what it is. It's very powerful. You get choices.
But how easy is it to convince them of that? I mean, we talked about, to begin with, you know, various communities and cultural identities. And how difficult, how easy is it to do that when you have a group, you have a girls, you know, in a gang?
Yeah.
How do you...
Very, very difficult. And what we're trying to do, what I try and do with my inclusion unit, with my learning mentors, and with organisations like Brian's New Britain, that we give them interventions and experiences which give them a sense of their own successes or themselves, so that they can, and a level of engagement, so that they can direct their energy and their time into something positive. And it's just chipping away, chipping away, chipping away. And at some point, hoping that there is a corner that they turn and that they have enough of the positive intervention and experiences where they don't have that pull, which is a negative one. Sometimes we don't access children and we can't. It's just one of those things. And it's quite sad because, you know, you can't always access a child, but we try with all the positive interventions, enough of the same, enough of positive experiences, and hopefully that sum total will have a positive outcome in the end.
I think also what you can, what we've done in the past is get them to analyze their preconceptions and try to dispel the myths. And you can do that through you know, analyzing movies and musics, and actually looking at the layers that we put on ourselves and we call identities. And if we can actually see sometimes of the part that we don't play in creating our own identity, then that can empower us to give us choice to say, okay, now what are we going to create for ourselves? So, yeah, but I understand there's so many different kind of connotations on top of that, especially when you're coming from a different cultural background, because you've got the duality of two different cultures and you've got, you know, especially if they're opposing cultures, you're trying to be free, you know.
Or do you identify as English or British?
That's a very funny.
Put you
one.
On the spot there.
Do you know, I've got a good friend of mine called David Mark, and I probably have to quote what he says. He says that when he attaches all these different titles onto himself, the one that seems to be most comfortable is a Londoner. Is a Londoner, because I think it reflects being cosmopolitan. So I'll probably look at myself as a Londoner.
Can I look at myself as a Londoner with an Irish accent?
There is a capability, there's a capacity for that. I think London encompasses so many different cultures and so many different identities, different orientations, religions. It's just such an amazing city that you can just feel that you can just be in and fit in.
It's interesting because I would first and foremost call myself Irish and wear it with pride, and you also do with your heritage, but you've chosen not to.
Well, no. I mean, I would say my identity will change with whichever forum I'm in as well.
Right.
So, you know, because you know, my family is Jamaican and I consider myself Jamaican as well. But to all intents and purposes, depending on where I'm asked the question, I will probably give a different answer. But because I will have many different dual identities in itself, and each one of them will come out depending where I am. So make myself sound really confusing.
No, it's true. It's us.
But I am English. I am a Londoner. I am Jamaican. I'm a West Indian person. I'm Caribbean. I'm all these different things. You know, I'm somebody who originated from Africa, and you know, all these other things thrown in to make who I am.
You're a melting pot.
Yeah, I've been told that before.
But you know, we could tie ourselves up in knots in terms of talking about cultural identities.
Absolutely.
And what are they doing, Cecily? Are they all laughing?
I don't know. Do you know, sometimes when you look at identity, you're asking, okay, now what purpose will the answer serve? And sometimes the identity you're trying to portray is something to be inclusive. Sometimes it's something to do with a sort of historical reference to who you are. Because I suppose if I'm on the street and I'm saying to people, I'm a Londoner, and they're saying, no, where are you from? And they're drilling down. And sometimes you don't need to go there, and sometimes you do.
I work with a white Jamaican, and he has a wonderful Jamaican accent.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. That gets him into no end of bother. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. Do you want to sing for us, Cecily? Is it time for a song, Cecily? Are you going to sing tonight?
Well.
No. Oh, okay. Finger caught. Do you want to say something in here? Do you want to hear yourself?
It's an oyster.
Oh, what are we talking about? Are we going to sing Row, Row, Row Your Boat? No? What do we want to sing? Do we want to sing? What do we want? We don't want to sing anything tonight. No?
No.
Not very talkative. It's quite an experience to hear herself back through the mic. She sang last week for us, a rather inappropriate number, I think. But nevertheless, we've got 10 minutes, and I'm wondering if we can sort of like sum up with what we might think we can do. I mean, I'd like to think every week I'm doing my bit, but I'm not sure it's making any difference. Well, I mean, nothing feels like it's making any difference when you're in the thick of it, but
the mire of it. But I think you are. I think, you know, being putting your radio show, or even being a mother and questioning.
But surely being a teacher, because you've not just got the next generation, you've got a whole lot of them in one go that you can affect. And it comes with enormous responsibility.
It does, and it does feel sometimes... when my students have got exams, and I felt like a bit of a mother hen, because my year 11s have got exams, maths exams, and I'm being very sort of caring and sort of... I am always very aware of the fact that my interaction can be positive or negative, and I can turn off somebody off my subject, or I can actually motivate somebody into actually pursuing that career.
Now, I have to pick up on what you've just said there in terms of mothering this, because nobody in the room apart from myself is actually a mother, or a father. But nevertheless, you've put yourselves in very caring roles.
Yeah.
But to use the word mother...
Yeah.
Somehow you identify those...
Those kind of emotions. And actually, maybe it's being a human. It's actually showing it's a human aspect, but...
But it seems like it's a very feminine one somehow to... This is how, you know, we identify mother as caring, nurturing, loving, you know, wiping snot and all the rest that goes with it. So
yeah, I've done that a fair times, yeah. No.
So worrying about your students and their exams somehow means you feel like you're mothering them?
Yeah.
Sloco parentis, isn't it? I think for me, me and my team have that nurturing. We try and nurture the child because we have to deal with behaviour. We have to deal with extreme behaviour. We have to deal with quite a lot of the vulnerabilities of our girls. We try and nurture them. And with that nurture comes that loco parentis, maybe a mother role, maybe... sort of a caring adult. But one thing we do want to put in is institutional love. Mm. I think I got that from Camilla from Kids Company around a wonderful woman around how in systems can be very very cold and not very personable. Yeah. But she alluded to the system trying to be a human being to that child or to that person and having institutional love, because we can express that.
Yeah.
And that is the human side of interacting with another human being and caring for them. So I think I take that role very seriously.
So do I. I mean, I think it's important to have that as a teacher, for me personally, because it means that my classroom is a safe environment for my students to be themselves and express themselves. So I think, in a way, I know I sort of say nurturing, mothering, but I do know that my students will ultimately feel quite safe in my presence, and they'll feel quite safe within my environment. And in doing that, it's also opened up a number of students to be able to talk to me freely.
Mm. Brian, do you feel like a father sometimes?
Yeah, I feel
you
like
work with a lot of young people.
I do feel like a father, and I'd probably like to add, I do feel like a mother. Yeah. If we were going to just look at the qualities.
Yeah,
because,
definitely.
I think, and this is some of the problems I think we have with lots of young men growing up today in today's society, because they do look at the softer, gentler characteristics as feminine
and weak
and weak, and it's something of beauty, and it's also something that it's important to have to balance your other masculine traits. So there's something that we shouldn't really neglect in ourselves.
And it's interesting that you feel that, you know, you can use the term mother as well.
Mm.
I'd like to say, Kat Phillips, if you're listening, because Kat, a colleague of mine on Enemies of Good Art, really believes that men can mother also.
Absolutely.
And until we start to identify that as a possibility, that we're never going to cross that major gap.
Yeah, I mean, I remember going to this class and there was a guy giving a lecture about identity and he says, how do you spell player? And how he spelled it was P-L-A-Y-H-E-R. And it was the element of a man playing the female elements or what he considered to be the female elements of himself to be a harder type of person. So he wasn't gentle, he wasn't soft, he wasn't considerate. And that made him a tougher man. And but really what it really does is destroy you as a man. Because we have a host of emotions. We have a whole range, a rainbow of emotions to express ourselves fully. And I think when we limit ourselves, we sort of... we destroy ourselves
in
a way.
Yeah.
And we don't have a chance to really savor society or savor life, really, or communication. Yeah. So it's important that we don't restrict because of our egos, any elements of our true character and our true natures. So,
and actually exploring as a woman sometimes in the classroom, having to explore the masculine side as well.
Right.
And sort of putting it, when you have to put in the disciplines and the boundaries and create and establishing sort of ground rules for how the interaction within your classroom would be. So sometimes you sort of have to adopt the masculine as well as the feminine and interplay those genders within your classroom.
Yeah, I'd like to say you have to be strong enough to have gentle qualities within you. It's not a weakness, it's a strength. It's a strength.
So what are you going to do collectively? Are you going to work collectively for the Women of the World Festival?
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah, we've been asked to.
Wow Education.
A Wow Education front.
What's Wow Education going to do?
Well, I mean, I've got some kind of stuff. With the values of New Britain is basically allowing us to develop social skills, improve self-esteem, enhance confidence and public speaking, enhance peer interaction, peer-to-peer education, provide a stronger and enjoyable relationship with participants and a better educational experience totally. And also to creating self-awareness and learn about other cultures and breaking down barriers to learning. When people don't acquire well, don't do well in school, it's not because they're not intelligent or they don't know enough. Sometimes it's because they have a bad relationship with the teaching environment or a teacher or even probably
a
bad preconception. And sometimes when you see a person really struggling with the educational system, if you look back, their parents struggled and their parents' parents struggled. So when it comes to a support system to say, you can talk to your sister, you can talk to their teachers, they can give you support. They don't really know how to get that support. They don't know how to do it. So, hopefully what we can create something around getting young people to look at the power they really have and actually start harnessing it.
And looking at readdressing this concept of equality. So if we're looking at the disparity and coming to a consensus about equality and actually seeing each other.
Yeah.
And this thing about seeing each other.
Yeah.
Really, it's not the image that's being projected or preconceptions. It's actually seeing each other as individuals and who they are.
And I think also it's about dialogue.
Absolutely.
Because even at the weekend, with the women's organisation, within the women's organisation, we have to understand there's many different social groups, religious, cultural, racial
well,
as well.
And of course you have to bring the boys in as well.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You have to bring the boys in. The festival. We've got about a minute and a half left, so I'm going to wrap up. And I think it's been a great show and I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you. It's been enlightening.
Thank you very much.
To my guests and also... I'd like to say that we've got three current students and a recent graduate art students coming on next week to talk about life after education and when's a good time to have a baby, and I'm going to try and convince them to do it now. So
26.
I know. Yeah, 26. I know I'm not going to win that battle, but nevertheless. So thank you very much. And you've been listening to Enemies of Good Art. Oh, can we just before we go plug New Britain?
Okay, and it's spelled NUBRITON. That's newbritain.com.
Okay, good night and thank you. Oh no, we've got
one last thing, because the whole idea with Wow Education is that at the moment it feels quite amorphous because we haven't got quite a vision yet. And I think it would be great if other teachers who could come and help us and work collaboratively put some ideas together and we'll start to see how it can form.
And contact Domino Pateman at the South Bank Centre.
Brilliant.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
Good night.